Chapter 8. For 3 years after taking the oath of office as United States Senator in March 1953, Johnny had been moved slowly by Raymond's mother to ensure acceptance within the Senate and in official Washington, to learn to know all of the press gentlemen well, to arrange the effective timing for the start of his run for re-election. In short, to master the terrain. It seems almost impossible now to credit the fact that halfway through his first time in office, Johnny Isolin was still one of the least known members of the Senate. It was not until April 1956 that Raymond's mother decided to try out the first substantial issue. On the morning of April 9th, Johnny showed up at the press briefing room at the Pentagon to attend a regularly scheduled press conference of the Secretary of Defense. He walked into the conference with two friends who represented Chicago and Atlanta papers, respectively. They had had coffee first. Johnny had asked them elaborately what they were up to that morning. They told him they were due at the Secretary's regular weekly press conference at 11 o'clock. Johnny said wistfully that he had never seen a really big press conference in action. He was such an obscure, diffident, pleasant, whiskey-tinted little senator that one of them good-naturedly invited him to come along and thereby unwittingly won himself a $250 prize bonus 3 weeks later from his newspaper. Johnny was so lightly regarded at that time, although extremely well-known to all the regulars covering the Washington beat, that if he was noticed at all, no one seemed to think it a bit unusual that he should be there. However, immediately after the press conference, writers who had not been within 500 miles of Washington that morning claimed to have been standing beside Johnny when he made his famous accusation. Editorialists, quarterly magazine contributors, correspondents for foreign dailies, and all other trend tenders used up a lot of time and wood pulp and, collectively, earned a lot of money writing about that extraordinary morning when a senator chose to cry out his anguish and protest at a press conference held by the Secretary of Defense. The meeting, held in an intimate amphitheater that had strong lights for the newsreel and television cameras, and many seats for correspondents, opened in the expected manner as the secretary, a white-haired, florid, terrible-tempered man, strode on stage to the lectern flanked by his press secretaries, and read his prepared statement concerned with that week's official view of integration of the nation's military and naval and air forces into one loyal unit. When he had finished, he inquired into the microphones with sullen suspicion whether there were any questions. There were the usual number of responses from those outlets instructed to bait the secretary, as was done in solemn rotation, to see if he could be goaded into one of his outrageous quotes that were so contemptuous of the people as to not only sell many more newspapers, but to give all of the arid columnists of think pieces something significant to write about. The secretary did not rise to the bait. As the questions came in more slowly, he began to shuffle his feet and shift his weight. He coughed and was making ready to escape when a loud voice, tremulous with moral indignation, but brave with its recognition of duty, rang out from the center of the briefing room.
"I have a question, Mr. Secretary."
The secretary peered forward with some irritation at this stranger who had seen fit to take his own slow time about getting to his stupid question.
"Who are you, sir?" he said sharply,
for he had been trained into politeness to the press by a patient team of wild horses, and by many past dislocations, which had been extremely painful, resulting from getting his foot caught in his mouth.
"I am United States Senator John Yerkes Isolin, sir," the voice rang out, "and I have a question so serious that the safety of our nation may depend upon your answer."
Johnny made sure to shout very slowly, so that before he had finished, every newspaper man in the room had located him and was staring at him with that expectant lust for sensation which was their common emotion.
"Who?"
the secretary asked incredulously, his voice electronically amplified, making it sound like the mating call of a giant owl.
"No evasions, Mr. Secretary," Johnny yelled. "No evasions, if you please."
The secretary owned a tyrant's temper, and he had been one of the most royal of big business dynasts before he had become a statesman.
"Evasions?" he roared. "What the hell are you talking about? What kind of foolishness is this?"
That sentence alone, those few words all by themselves, served to alienate the establishment called the United States Senate from sympathy with his cause for the rest of his tenure in office, For, no matter what the provocation, it is the first unwritten law of the United States of America that one must never, never, never speak to a senator, regardless of his committee status, in such a manner before the press. The members of the press present, who now recognized Johnny in his official status, grew lightheaded over the implications of this head-on encounter of two potentially great sellers of newspapers, magazines, and radio and television time. It was one of those pulsing moments, auguring an enormous upward surge in profits, when one half of the jaded turned thrilled, stamped out their cigarettes, and the other half lighted up theirs, all staring greedily.
I said, I am United States Senator John Yerkes Iceland, and I hold here in my hand a list of 207 persons who are known to the Secretary of Defense as being members of the Communist Party and who nevertheless are still working and shaping the policy of the Defense Department.
What?
The Secretary had to shout out his astonishment into the microphones to be heard over the excited keening and rumbling of the voices in the room.
I demand an answer, Mr. Secretary, Johnny cried, waving a clutch of papers high over his head, his voice a silver trumpet of righteousness.
The secretary had turned from beet red to magenta. He was breathing with difficulty. He gripped the lectern before him as though he might decide to throw it at Johnny.
If you have such a list, Senator, God damn it, he bellowed, bring it up here. Give me that list. There will be no covering up, Mr. Secretary. You will not put your hands on this list. I regret deeply to say, in front of all these men and women, that you no longer have my confidence.
What?
This is no longer a matter for investigation by the Department of Defense. I am afraid you have had your chance, sir. It has become the responsibility of the United States Senate.
Johnny turned and strode from the room, leaving chaos behind him. On the following day, consistent with the booking made weeks previously and involving a token expenses payment of $250, Johnny was to appear on Defenders of Our Liberty, a television program that was a showcase for the more conservative members of the government. An interview show on which questions of a non-straightforward nature were asked before a national audience, representing one of the lowest ratings of any program in the history of the medium, the program remaining on the air only because the sponsoring company found it generally useful, and, of course, pleasant to be able to dine with the important weekly guests following each show, when a special vice president would make firm friends with them to continue the discussion of government problems and problems with government of a more or less specific nature over the years to come. Johnny had been invited to appear on the show because he was one of the two senators remaining in office whom the company's special vice president had never had to dinner, and the special vice president was not one to underestimate. However, on the day of his scheduled appearance, Johnny was the hottest statesman in the country as a result of 30 hours of continuous coverage, and he had become an object of great importance to the television show and to its network. Wherever they could, in the extremely short time they had in which to turn around, they bought half-page advertisements in big city newspapers to herald Johnny's live appearance on the show. Raymond's mother let everything develop in a normal manner, up to a point. Johnny was due to go on the air at 7:30 p.m. At 1 p.m., she told them regretfully that he would not be available, that he was too busy preparing what would be the most important investigation the Senate had ever held. The network reeled at this news. The sponsor reeled. The press prepared to reel. After only the least perceptible stagger, the special vice president asked that a meeting between Raymond's mother and himself be quickly and quietly arranged. Raymond's mother preferred to hold this kind of a meeting in a moving car, far away from recording devices. She drove herself, and the two of them rode around the city of Washington and hammered out an agreement that guaranteed Johnny not less than 6 nor more than 12 appearances on Defenders of Our Liberty each year for 2 years, at the rate of $7,500 worth of common stock of the sponsoring company per appearance, and for which Johnny would supply the additional consideration of staying in the news, in such a manner as could be reviewed after every 3 shows by the special vice president and Raymond's mother jointly, to the point where the contract could be canceled or extended by mutual consent.